Yo.
We got Mark Steves.
Yes.
AKA Mystic Mark from the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast, a true OG of conspiracy podcasting. I was fortunate enough, and Mark was kind enough to give me the opportunity to speak on his podcast a few months back before I had any clout, if you will, before Mike and I had even started this show. And I was on his show, so stoked and honored to get him as a guest on our show. He's got a lot of knowledge, a lot of stuff to share, so this is sure to be a great one.
Yes, this is going to be a fun one. Yeah, you might know him, like Tom said, from his podcast, his very successful podcast, My Family Thinks I'm Crazy. Mine does too, as probably does yours if you are a fan of our show. But yeah, as Tom said, our show was just a sperm floating in our mutual sacks of creativity before he went on that show. You may notice a little tinge in Tom's voice. He is a little bit under the weather. However, his audio sounds so perfect that you guys probably didn't even notice that.
Yeah, I'm feeling a little crappy, but I've had plenty of technical difficulties experimenting with different microphones and having to use my phone and, you know, kind of just being a dummy when it comes to technology. So thank you all for bearing with me.
You definitely sound much, much clearer. And, you know, we're still infants in this game, in this pod. Well, I had a show in 2016, but, you know, I got out of the game. I consider us pretty much infants in this podcast game. It's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to figure things out as we go. And, yeah, you know, if we do have any questions, we can always ask old Mark Steves.
Exactly. We got the, like I said, the OG to get some advice from.
He is one of the OGs. I mean, really next to Greg Carlwood and the Higher Side Chats. You know, in my mind, of course, you have Sam Tripoli, who was amazingly gracious enough to invite us into the green room after his comedy show that we saw the other night. Of course, he's an OG. But yeah, like you said, dude, I consider Mark, you know, he's right there. He's right there. If he's not the guy, he's right there by the guy.
I mean, yeah, you'll hear when he drops some knowledge on the podcast. He's definitely got no shortage of things to talk about. Had some of the craziest guests I've ever heard. Like, I'm a big fan of his show. I've heard most of the episodes, but there's so many, there's no way I've heard them all. But some of the craziest shit I've ever learned has come from his show.
Yeah, the thing I like about My Family Thinks I'm Crazy is he has everybody from, you know, the leading experts in their field of research in this realm of crazy conspiracy madness. But he also will bring on, you know, like Tom said, at the time he was an elite wrestler, but the world didn't know Tom Higgins yet, really. My point is, Mark is willing to have everybody in the gambit on his show. If you got something interesting and you know what you're talking about, he will have you on. And I thought that was really cool. That's an interesting way to run his podcast, because not everybody does that. That allows us as listeners, like you said, to really benefit, because it has opened my eyes up to so many different things that I had no fucking idea even existed, dude.
Yeah, he's got some super intelligent and, you know, academic guests, and then you get some of the wildest woo-woo, metaphysical, and a little bit out there guests, which always makes for a good conversation, and I would love to follow his lead here.
For the people that are listening, we thank all you guys. No matter which continent you reside on, we appreciate all the love and support and the downloads so far. Please continue it. Give us the 5-star reviews. Also, follow us on all the social media platforms, X, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram. I know I said X and Twitter, same thing, but, you know, go ahead and do all those things. It's Two Truth Seekers. That is the podcast. Email us, because we're trying to build a community out of this motherfucker. conspiracyandchill@yahoo.com. And, yeah, man, Mark fucking Steves, Mystic Mark.
I'm sure the listeners will get a kick out of this one.
Should we let him hear it?
Run it. So we got Mark Steves, a.k.a. Mystic Mark, the host of the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. He was gracious enough to have me as a guest on his show a few months back before, you know, I had anything to offer as far as my own show. So very stoked to have him on here. It was a great conversation, and this one's going to be sure to be no different. What's up, Mark?
Hey, thanks for having me. Yeah, it was great to have you on my show, and it's a pleasure to meet you, Mike. Happy to be here on the Conspiracy and Chill podcast. I hope I got that right, or maybe the Chill and Conspiracy podcast.
No, you're right. You're good. Conspiracy. It's a play on the Netflix and Chill, you know?
Love it. Conspiracy and Chill. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Great to meet you, Mike and Tom. Yeah, good to talk to you again.
Absolutely. So my guy Mike here used to run a show called Reality Roundhouse, and that's actually how I met him, was back in like 2016. I was on his show. You and your show obviously is one of the longest running and OG conspiracy podcasts, if you will. So kind of want to dive into a little bit about how you got started with that, or what kickstarted it. And Mike's got a couple things he'd like to ask you too, so go ahead, Mike.
What did you do before you were podcasting? You sound so polished as a speaker. I was just curious.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, and I'll take the compliment, but I would not say by any means I'm an OG podcast. I feel like I got into it way late. But to answer your question, Mike, I was on the road as a delivery driver for a while. I dropped out of college in my sophomore year, and I was just kind of disillusioned with everything. You know, in inner rim between classes, I would explore New Haven, Connecticut, where Yale University is, and I was a student at a community college basically right next door. So I would explore Yale, and I just really became kind of jaded in one sense to think like, oh wow, look at this amazing school next to my like community college that feels like high school 2.0. And I start learning about all this strange stuff that's going on there, from Skull and Bones to the weird medical things that maybe if this is a YouTube podcast we could stray away from, but just, you know, odd things that I would hear just from being in that city. You know, growing up not too far away from the city, it was really surprising, because although I lived pretty close, you know, I was kind of a suburban kid. I stuck to what I could reach on my bicycle, you know, before I could drive. And that was my world. So yeah, long story short, after I realized college was kind of scamming me, or in other words, not really what I had bargained for, I dropped out and decided to pursue a sort of autodidactic path, you know, a self-education. And at first it was mostly books, because although podcasts had existed back then, I wasn't aware of them, and I wasn't aware that there was even any type of media that really talked about this kind of stuff outside of the clearly controlled sectors, like History Channel kind of gives you some hints into this world of weirdness, but really from a mainstream, give you no answers kind of point of view. So I kind of picked up on all that, and somehow, some way, it was either like Joe Rogan or whatever, somebody was like, podcast. And then I just started digging, and I realized, like, from this dishwashing job that I had for a few months, that like, and this was before the whole podcast thing, I had found like these Joseph Campbell lectures that they used to have on Spotify, and I was dishwashing, and I was like, oh wow, this is such a breeze. Like, I hated dishwashing, but I love it now, because I could just sit here all day, listen to these Joseph Campbell archives, and my mind was just in this whole nother world. You know, he's describing all these world myths and stories from around the world and how it all fits together in this kind of Jungian way, and that was all very appealing for me. But then when I found podcasting, it was really, you know, because the Joseph Campbell stuff is still academic enough to where it didn't quite offer the same gnosis that podcasting did. It wasn't the red pill that I was looking for quite yet. It still was like school, tedious. But yeah, that led me to realize like, okay, I should get jobs where I'm being paid to learn. Because with the dishwashing thing, like, yeah, I could kind of get away with listening to stuff with headphones on, but only when I was dishwashing, not when I was doing other stuff around the deli, right? So then I was like, all right, well, let's get a delivery job again. Because when I first got out of high school, that's what I did. I delivered Chinese food, smoked pot, and listened to music. And that was, I loved it. I was in my own world that I kind of controlled, even though I had a boss who would yell at me occasionally for smelling like weed. He was a good guy, and he gave me a lot of freedom. So I kind of looked for jobs like that, and with the thought in mind, like, all right, I'm going to spend the 8 hours a day listening to podcasts. And yeah, some of them were comedy podcasts, maybe not all that productive, but I found, in my opinion, what I consider the OG podcast, which would be like the Higher Side Chats, mm-hmm. the Greg America Show, and of course, obviously, my number one favorite, Tinfoil Hat, which there's a whole story on how I got connected with Sam and started working with him. Eventually, I just found myself like really having this sense of like, I could be doing this, and, you know, I could be participating in the conversation, not in some kind of like egoic kind of way of like, I could say it better, but it was more like, I just want to participate in the conversation, you know, and share what I've learned and talk about the books that I've been reading. And, you know, it's kind of funny, I never thought of it in college, like that any of that stuff would lead to an actual job, but it did in this really kind of synchronistic roundabout way, where like the books that I didn't think were really in any curriculum, you know, like my favorite back then was The Secret History of the World by Mark Booth, The Secret Teachings of All Ages by Manly P. Hall, very similar title, kind of a similar theme, but also very different. And I would read books like that and think to myself like, oh, well, there was that one professor that mentioned conspiracy theories, but outside of him, it was like a lot of the same, you know, hamster wheel garbage. And I just thought there's got to be something else. And yeah, like I said, in a roundabout kind of synchronistic way, my life kind of pushed me through these different circumstances that I think built up into a pretty cool resume for what I do now. But it's like, you know, I never handed Sam Tripoli my resume and said like, oh, hey, like, I've been reading all these books for years. You know, it just kind of, I don't know, life kind of works itself out that way through frequency and vibration and putting the right energy into something, you know? And that's kind of what happened to me in a really big, profound way, specifically with Tinfoil Hat, because I think a lot of people can relate to the sense of like, I listened to something that I loved and then I became a part of it, right? So I booked the guests on Tinfoil Hat, but when I first started listening to that show, I had no idea that I would ever even know Sam, let alone, you know, work for him, right? Or like ever meet him, let alone work for him. But yeah, I ended up just like really becoming a fan of the show. I went to go see Sam live in New York City. He had a comedy show at the Gramercy Theater. And then after the show, he was doing the kind of meet and greet photo shoot kind of thing. And he was telling everybody like, oh, if you guys want to hang out and talk, come to the Creek in the Cave, which was a different comedy club in the area. Yeah, I just by happenstance had struck up a friendship with some of the guys that I was waiting in line with, and they're like, oh yeah, let's go. And I'm like, shit, can I hop, you know, hop a ride with you guys? Cause you know, I'm not from New York City. I didn't have a car that I was willing to drive into New York City at the time. So I took the train in, cause that's a whole nightmare having a car in New York City. I'm sure you guys can relate being close to Chicago.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, so long story short, I gave Sam a book. I don't think he ended up reading it, at least when I gave it to him. It's called The Kybalion. It's like the, you know, seven hermetic laws. And I just gave it to him because I thought, you know, it would kind of open up a new perspective on a lot of things that he was talking about at the time. And I reached out to him on the Patreon that he had at the time. And I was like, oh, hey, did you read that book I gave you? And he's like, no, but you should come on my show and tell me about it, you know? So I did. I went on his Patreon show and I went on a couple more times. And then he started a spiritual podcast and he asked me to be a guest on it. And then after it was, you know, finished recording, he's like, who should I have on next? And I'm like, oh, I'll send you a list of people. And I sent him a list so long that I think he felt like, okay, this guy's clearly the right guy to do this. And he just said, oh, do you want to, you know, help me out and find guests for this show? And I'll pay you for, you know, and see how you do and yada, yada. And that evolved into me eventually booking for Tinfoil Hat in a short amount of time because he was kind of impressed with it. And it also created my podcast, because in that same span of time, I had a podcast with some friends. Yeah, the name was there, but it wasn't really like, I didn't really like the name of it. And then when I told my family that I started working for Sam, I was so stoked, because part of it was like, you know, everything was going on with the
radio edit,
and the job I had at that time was starting to really drain me with the wearing the masks and all that. I would never wear my mask at work because I was a delivery guy, and you know, nobody was really with me in my truck. So it's like, who's going to enforce it, right? But whenever I was loading up the truck or waiting in line in the morning, it was too much, and I didn't want to participate. So I told my family, like, I'm quitting this delivery job. I'm going to go work for this podcast guy. And they're like, what? Doesn't he live in like California? Like, what are you talking about? You're working for some guy in California. You know, they are all happy for me because Amazon, you know, that's a big deal getting a job there. But I think, nah, screw Amazon. I don't need this, you know? So yeah, that's kind of where the name My Family Thinks I'm Crazy really dawned on me. It was like the afternoon I told some of my family members, like my aunt and some cousins, that I had like quit my job. And because my parents, like, they love me, you know, they put up resistance, they'll argue with me about stuff, but they know he's gonna do what he's gonna do, right? So, but with my extended family, there's a little more pressure there, because I like to put on my, you know, best foot forward, so to speak, with the people who aren't that close to me, I guess. So when I tell them that, you know, oh yeah, I'm not a delivery driver anymore, I'm working this podcast thing, they all kind of looked at me like I was nuts, like I had thrown my life away or something. And I just thought that was so funny, because it's like, well, you guys clearly don't know me that well if you think this is a bad move, you know? So it just kind of made me really happy, and I had this like big grin on my face, like, all right, I'll show them, like, let's see how long this thing goes. And and it's, you know, it's turned out really well. I'm still grinning about it in that sense, but yeah, that's kind of where the name comes from. And it stems from just my relationship with them my whole life, which is just like this kind of overall positive, but also on the mental sphere, I've always felt like my ideas were a little too radical for some people to accept, right? And that causes some fun conversations, arguments, debates, fights even, because sometimes people just don't want to hear it. They don't want their comfortable worldview to be questioned. And, you know, I live that life. I'm not doing this for the podcast. Like, that's my life. I've had to deal with that. I've had to deal with the consequences of, you know, kind of alienating people by being dedicated to something you believe in. And, you know, there's different walks of life that might lead you to a position like that. There are different situations. And, you know, I think I'm pretty lucky that I have a pretty good family, in the sense that they didn't like traumatize me or abuse me or anything like that. So I'm not like complaining and saying like, oh, my family sucks. Like, I love my family deep down, but there is like this like interesting maybe generational divide, because, you know, I don't know how young you guys are, but I assume you guys are probably around the same age as me. And, you know, we're part of this kind of, I guess you could call it, internet generation, in the sense that we've kind of grew up with the access to the internet in a way that older generations didn't have access to it. And I think that's kind of, I mean, that's really why I love podcasting too, I guess, in the sense that, like, I'm not really an internet geek. I've never really been like an internet guy. I've always been able to find the information I wanted to find on the internet. Like, I've always used it for that resource. And I don't know that there's ever been a resource like that, at least in our recorded history. You know, in the past, people would have to dig through stacks and stacks of books to find information. And I imagine that took a very specific type of person. And nowadays, I think the amount of energy required to really even understand a great deal of information, it's gone down quite a bit. And that's what makes podcasting so awesome, is because all that time I spent, you know, a couple years, 4 or 5 years being a delivery guy, absorbing all this information, listening to, you know, the guys I look up to, it definitely, you know, it gave me a good foundation to start my own and set me in the right direction as far as what to talk about, who to talk to. And so in that sense, I definitely think I put my time in, you know, as far as like getting ready to start this podcast. But you can also interpret that as like, I was probably procrastinating a great bit too, because there was a few years where I was like, I would just think about starting a podcast and I never did. So I'm very grateful that things worked out the way they did. And Sam kind of lit a fire under me and got me going in a way that hasn't ceased. So yeah, that's kind of the long way of saying what I did before I started my podcast.
I love all that. And the name is obviously extremely relatable to anyone with our mindset, if you will. And a lot of what you said, I can relate to as well, because among my job as like a coach and a trainer, I have a part-time warehouse job, and I've logged plenty of hours listening to your podcast, listening to Sam's podcast, and then to have conversations with Sam on his Rockfin show and then you on your show. And it's kind of like came full circle the same way. Like I spent so much time listening to your guys' info and thinking like, man, I would love to talk to these guys. So yeah, that's epic. I really love everything you said.
I second
that. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, no, and you know, it hit me in a flash, you know, and afterwards I was like, yeah, wow, that phrase, my family thinks I'm crazy, is pretty relatable. Like I didn't really think about it at that time because it was so like personal in that moment. And then another podcast friend that I've spoken to a couple times now, he's in Norway, a great guy, his name's Al, his podcast is called Forum Borealis. And he's like, oh Mark, that your name, the name of your podcast reminds me of a saying that we have in our country. He's like, I'm going to translate it to English. And then he translates it to English. He's like, oh yeah, I think this is a saying in English too. He's like, I've heard it in English too. And he's like, it's something like a prophet is never recognized in his own village or his own country, right? Like something like that. And I'm not saying like, oh, I'm a prophet and I have some crazy information. I think that's just more a comment on like when people get red pilled, the people closest to them are always like, what are you? You're crazy. You know what I mean? So it's really kind of, it's not even like something that, you know, I feel any ownership on. I think it's really more of a commentary on the time we're living in, you know, like that phrase, oh, my family thinks I'm crazy, is like a thought that you have after you get red pilled or after you are awakened or, you know, after you have this moment of enlightenment, you know, however that comes to you.
Mike and I just went to go see Sam on Friday here in Illinois, and same thing, after the show, he was, you know, hanging out selling t-shirts, and I went and talked to him, and he remembered me from the Rockfin show, and he brought us back into the green room, and we bullshitted and talked for a while, got his number, he's going to come on the show, and hopefully me get on the tinfoil, get Mike on the tinfoil hat, and yeah, so that also is a parallel to what you were saying, too.
I love that, yeah, well, I'm sure I'll be helping facilitate that. So yeah, we could talk more about that after the show, you know, the emails and whatnot. But cool, man. Yeah, I think that's the other side of it, is like that we're living in like a new, more connected time, and it's a smaller world than maybe at least I used to think, you know, and maybe other people feel that way too. And you know, the success of someone like Sam or a podcast like his is only an indication of how many people are on this new level of thinking, I guess. I mean, who knows if it's new? Maybe, you know, 200 years ago, people were questioning everything like this and they just didn't write it down. But I think what we have access to with all the podcasts and stuff is like, this new technology of consciousness. You know, it's more than just the ability to call someone up from long distance. It's like the recording these conversations and putting them out for people to find is doing something positive for the collective consciousness. And I think it manifests in synchronicities, because I know tons of people who have, including myself, synchronicities based on the podcast they listen to, or even synchronicities in life that lead them to listen to the podcast. I have my own personal like synchronicities in life that led me to discover some things about New Haven and Skull and Bones, and that kind of in another way led me to look into the history of New England and look into the actual history and what's been written out, what's been left out, what's been forgotten or censored. And so on that note, you know, I can't say specifically why or what it is doing that for me. Maybe it's my higher self, maybe it's the creator of all this consciousness that we're all in, that's kind of, you know, moving us around like cells in our own body. I don't know, but something synchronistically kind of put Skull and Bones and that conspiracy research on my radar. And, you know, I think my podcast has covered that topic in a way that other shows haven't. Typically, when you have like a conspiracy podcast that talks about any one of these groups, they'll tell you the known history of the group and then the speculation attached to it. That's fine. But there's really just like one or two of researchers who have actually done really good source work on Skull and Bones and gone back and looked at the history. And I've researched that, and now I feel like I'm going a step further with all that. And, you know, that kind of involves understanding like the old world and the ancient history of America, which you mentioned you might want to get into in this conversation. But it's really, I think, you know, the reason I'm bringing it up maybe preemptively here is because it's synchronistic what led me to find this stuff. And I mean, I'm interested in so many things. My bookshelf has so many topics on it, but I only have so much time in the day, right? So I kind of let my intuition and that awareness of what's syncing up around me kind of guide what I'm going to research. And that, I think, has led me to find really cool stuff. And I almost think that that's how we're supposed to be researching. And in that way, we're all kind of contributing to this massive puzzle that is figuring out like who we are and what we're doing here, why we're here, you know, those big, huge questions that we're all faced with if we've ever confronted our existence.
You said you wanted to get into some of the old world, the United States, potentially any connections to Tataria, all that. But one thing I wanted to ask you is, you mentioned you covered so many topics on your podcast. Would you say that your favorite, like if you could only pick one of these topics to research for the rest of your life? I know that's ridiculous, but would it be Skull and Bones?
Well, I feel like that's too specific of a topic to spend a whole lifetime focusing on, and maybe that ends your life if you're not careful too, because there are people who maybe don't want people looking into that kind of stuff. So I try to stick with what's already been written about and published about. I don't actually go and like interview people at Yale or like do that kind of investigative type of work. So, yeah, if I committed my life to it, it would probably require that. And I don't know that I'm willing to do that. I'm more interested, I guess, in humanity in general. I know that's not really a good answer to your question, but I guess if I had to focus on one thing only on my podcast, it'd probably be history. And I guess that's still even vague. But just because history encompasses so many things, like, I mean, even the history of history is its own subject. So I think that's where I think you'll see a lot of my podcast episodes ending up. We do touch on the more metaphysical things. We touch on the more conspiratorial, even true crime-esque type things. And Skull and Bones kind of fits in all those areas. Side note, I apologize. There's been a bit of snow, so you guys might hear the plow. He just made it in front of my apartment. But yeah, difficult question. I hope history is okay, is an acceptable answer, but maybe not like as specific as maybe you were hoping for. But no, I don't think Skull and Bones would be my forever topic. That'd be a big commitment to make.
Yeah, history works. History works, man. Like you said, there's so much that encompasses. I could see someone spending a lifetime definitely just digging into that. So I think I cut you off last time, brother.
No, you're good, man. But seems like as good a time as any to
hell yeah
get into that then, because with history, I mean, obviously there's the accepted and academic version of it, and then there's, you know, what we can call the real history, I guess. And when it comes to America, you can't really, you know, deep dive America without getting into secret societies. When you consider the first presidents were all Freemasons, and the biggest, colleges and whatnot all have these fraternal organizations that are deeply entrenched in the occult. And even when it comes to, like, when we talked on your show, Mark, about giants and the Native Americans and like what cultures they were in contact with, and where do you think is a good place to get started with hidden or largely unknown American history?
Well, I mean, for the audience listening, I guess maybe the best thing I can do is tell my story with it and our story, so to speak, because I'm not alone in this. My girlfriend Tara has helped tremendously with all this and inspired a lot of it in many ways, because she initially was like, hey, I don't know much about my home state, and I've been all over the world. Not me, but her. She's been all over the world, and she was like, you know, I've been all over the world, and I don't know much about where I'm from. And whenever I talk to people in other places, they know so much about where they're from, and it makes me feel like I should know more about my homeland, you know, my home state. So her and I, you know, have that mutual interest of like, yeah, let's look into our own backyard. And you know, we've gone on a bunch of really amazing kind of trips that synchronistically brought different books into our attention, so to speak. And those books have kind of pushed our understanding forward in ways that, you know, I think were like predestined, right? And I'll give you some examples. So the first time we did a podcast interview together, we interviewed this woman who told us about her life and all this great stuff. And I think it was episode 52 of the podcast, a woman named Aurora. And she, you know, towards the end, she was asking us like, oh yeah, where are you guys from? And oh, I used to live around there. And she said, there's a vortex near where we're at out in New York, which is just over the border. You know, we're not too far, maybe an hour away from the border of Connecticut and New York. So we drive out there and go to the town, this town that most people probably know. It's called Woodstock, right? There's a whole festival there, and the whole music festival had, you know, all this craziness to it. Hundreds and thousands of people were there, right? So we go there, and it's just kind of like a normal tourist trap kind of town, but you know, more hippie-ish because of the Woodstock reputation. So there's this really cool bookstore in there called like the Maharishi Bookstore or something like that. It has like a or sort of Eastern kind of name, maybe like, I don't know, something that you would imagine like a yoga studio having a similar name, right? So we go in there and I'm just looking at all the different books, and it's so cool to be in a store where instead of these, because most bookstores, like, you'll have one shelf and it'll be all the cool stuff, right? Conspiracies, metaphysical stuff, weird alternative stuff, right? It's all usually in one little corner. If it's a good used bookstore, maybe they'll have like a more built out section and they'll have different categories. But this entire bookstore was just like the topics you'd expect to talk about on a show like this, right? So anything you can imagine. So I go into like the more specific genres and whatnot, and I'm looking around, and eventually I find like local, I think it was like local history or something like that, which is cool to find in a place like this with only like metaphysical kind of esoteric books, because it's like you're not just going to find like, oh, here's where the old popcorn factory was, you know, it's going to be more than just that. So I find a book called Spirit in the Stone, and it's all about this awesome, pretty much undervalued stone landscape that's all around us here in my part of the country in the Northeast. Just all over the place, there are these stone structures that a lot of them have no explanation. I mean, some of them are kind of similar to what you see in like megaliths in other countries, where scientists go and look at them and they're like, oh yeah, we can't figure out how someone could have lifted a stone like this. It's so heavy, right? So, and there's plenty of them that are just kind of like out in the woods. They're not even like, at least the Cahokia Mounds, you know, they have like a whole board of people preserving them, and you can go there and like, I don't know, like go and read a plaque about who used to hang out at the Cahokia Mounds, and who knows if that's even true, what they're saying about it. But here, you know, it's only a few of them that are really even kind of taken care of as historical sites. And that kind of, you know, made me scratch my head like, oh, why is that? Is it just because they don't want to appreciate like the Native American culture? Is it because the Native Americans didn't build them and they don't have an explanation for them? So they're just like, oh yeah, we shouldn't talk about these because it leads to the wrong kind of questions. You know, these are the things that were going through my mind. And we end up finding these other books that kind of coincide with that, right? So in the Spirit in the Stone book, not only did we learn about some of the finer aspects of the stones, but we kind of learned how these stones are in alignments with one another. And it's kind of funny because now I'm looking at it and I'm like, it was kind of backwards, because like the Spirit in the Stone is like the most advanced book out of the four or five that kind of came in sequence with each other. And the ones that followed it kind of clarified the points that the first one made. So like Spirit in the Stone talks a lot about the alignments of some of these structures and how not only are they aligned with each other across very vast distances, but they're also aligned with the equinox, the solstice, and various constellations. So if the anthropologists who are studying Native Americans, they're talking about Native Americans as these Stone Age people who can barely even figure out like the basic aspects of technology, right? This is the kind of unfair stigma that's been given to these people. Yet they have stone structures that are astronomically aligned. That doesn't add up, right? So, and again, it could be because the Native Americans came after a culture that had a more advanced understanding of that. It could be because the Native Americans once had a more advanced understanding of that, right? I mean, all of these possibilities are there. And even the Native Americans themselves have very complex myths and stories about the stars and beings from the stars, and not just beings from the stars, but underground and giants as well. So, you know, clearly we're dealing with something that it has a sophisticated understanding, but there isn't a sophisticated explanation being at least espoused in the academic or the mainstream. So that's kind of where I'm like scratching my head like, all right, so we have American Stonehenge, and it's this like, you know, basically tourist trap in New Hampshire. And I'm not necessarily against it, because, hey, they're preserving it and keeping, you know, ne'er-do-wells from going and destroying it, which is great. But why is that the only one that's accepted in the kind of academic mainstream? They're like, oh, yeah, the Vikings came over and they only made it so far into America. And yeah, they left some things behind, like this American Stonehenge and Newport Tower, and that's it. They just stopped there. I just, you know, I don't know. I don't quite buy that. You know, and Tom and I discussed this when Tom was a guest on my show. I think that when you look at the Native American and the Celtic cultures, there's a lot of similarities. And I'm not the only one saying this. Someone I'm a big fan of, Michael Wan, he first introduced me to this idea with one of his Susquehanna alchemy videos available on YouTube. Just type in Susquehanna, like the river, and alchemy. And all of his videos are there for free. You can go and check them out. But one of the key concepts that he mentioned in one of these early videos he put out is that the Algonquin speaking tribes, their language, this Algonquin language, it's kind of like a group of different languages that are similar and kind of evolved around the same like syntax and words. They have a root similarity to the Gaelic speaking cultures, right? So that in my mind opened up this huge like rabbit hole, and then I started learning about like Saint Brendan and Leif Erikson and like all these other people that were known to leave the quote unquote old world and discover things here in the quote unquote new world. But what if this quote unquote new world is the actual old world, right? I mean, that's possible. And I think anybody who takes some time to study what we know from history about Atlantis and what different cultures have remembered about the pre-flood times, it could be that there was an advanced culture here, you know, somewhere close to what's now North and South America. Maybe even some parts of what is now North and South America were a part of it, right? Seems like they were a seafaring culture, and it seems like there were islands that once existed, maybe continents even the size of, you know, at the very least Madagascar, but at the most maybe like Texas or Australia, right? Like a huge island in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean that sunk when the water level changed. And that's recorded fact. We know that happened, that the water level changed. And another recorded fact is humans live on the coast. You can go and look at the globe and take it for what it's worth, whether you believe in the globe or the flat earth or the satellites or the not, or the space is fake and homo or not. I mean, I don't know. But when you look at those pictures of the world at night and the lights, where the lights are, they're all around the coast. I mean, for the most part, outside of the major cities that are inland, and those tend to be near bodies of water as well, rivers and lakes and whatnot. So, you know, if there was a great flood, everything now that's on the coast would be sunk. So the same thing could have happened back then, right? And I think that's exactly why you have such similarities between North and South American cultures with European and African cultures. You have root similarities behind both of those separate, we're told, separate groups. But could it be that maybe they didn't evolve side by side after they were separated? They had similar trajectories, but the reason they're similar is because they came from the same source, right? They come from this pre-flood old world place that is now sunken for the most part, but probably still out in the open. I mean, we have pyramids, we have different megaliths like the ones that I'm describing here in New England that most people wouldn't consider, like, you know, on the same level as the Great Pyramid of Giza, but they're at least very similar to what we have all across the northern hemisphere, which is like Northern Europe, the British Isles, Russia, Scandinavia. You have all these similar stone structures, and go figure, you have them in Canada and south of Canada as well. So, you know, here in the US. And I mean, I'm sure there's plenty out in the West. I just haven't really been out there. So, but I have seen photos and stuff of different weird structures in the Rocky Mountains or in the desert and southwest of the United States. And obviously, Mexico has tons of interesting stuff. So, Yeah, I don't buy into this whole idea that, oh yeah, the people here in North America were just isolated for 12,000 years and after that, you know, Columbus came and saved them all and civilized the savages. You know, I think it's pretty well established at this point in time that that's kind of just a bias that they had back then, and it led to a lot of stuff being swept under the rug or suppressed consciously or not. You know, obviously lots of people's lives taken from them, whole cultures and civilizations destroyed. It's messy, messy business. And I'm sure the people in power, they just want to forget about it because they don't want to be culpable for any of that, right? So I think that's part of why there's a cover up with a lot of this stuff. You know, you don't, the governments that be, the British government, the French, the Spanish, they don't necessarily want to admit that their European cousins got to North America first, you know, because then that leaves them politically maybe, I don't know, culpable in some way to those countries that actually do have a proper land claim. So if you have all this evidence of like the Welsh here in America before England and so on got here, does that not throw into question some of those treaties and agreements that are at the foundation of the colonies and the country that we're in right now? So that's, I think that's probably a big part of this suppression too, is like they don't want that stuff to be out because those stone structures are like, you know, flags, you know, in a way. That'd be like China seeing the American flag on the moon, if it really is there, and throwing it away and putting their flag there and saying, oh, no, we were there first. You know, you never went to the moon. That was all a lie. That was a hoax. You made that up in Hollywood. We went to the moon first. Who knows? Maybe we've never been to the moon, and then 100 years from now, China will do that. I would if I was Xi Jinping.
Oh, yeah. When it comes to the whole Irish or Welsh thing of them possibly coming here beforehand, and as you mentioned, some of the Native American languages are very similar to Gaelic or other Celtic languages, and I've uncovered a lot of that myself, and some of the stone structures, they look pretty identical. And when you think, like, yeah, it's all along the East Coast in Canada, and it would make perfect sense that it lines up with some of the things you see in the west of Spain and Wales, Ireland, appearing over here as if there was like a landmass in between the very west of Europe and the Americas, where there was like a common culture that they shared, and maybe when it sunk, they spread out, and the only resources they had to use at that point was stones, instead of, say, if there was a super highly advanced Atlantis and the technology was lost, the culture fell, like they would have to resort to using stone and stuff if they were fully reset. And then you mentioned the giants and the whole red-haired giants thing, and the Celtic mythology is extremely rich with giants, and they even use the giants as, you know, like origin stories for how a lot of these are made. And I'm pretty sure the Native Americans are the same. Like they say they found these places, and or they'll be like, oh, the giant tribes made these. And when it comes to like Wales, Ireland, Cornwall, all those places have had their culture and their stories like heavily wiped out and suppressed too. So it does seem like there's been a effort to kind of silence or undermine their influence on things. And something I've found interesting too, as I've continued to deep dive down that, because that's kind of my area of obsession, is everything to do with Celtic and Irish history and stuff, is so there's probably only about, I don't know, I could be wrong, I'm just estimating or going off what I think, maybe like 5 million Irish people or whatever. And across the world, there's hundreds of millions of Irish people. And I don't know how that adds up. Like, it almost seems like they think that just after the potato famine in the 1800s, where at least a million people died from starvation and like died traveling over here, within just a couple generations, the population exploded to that level to be this many Irish people all across the world and in America. And there's the common cliche that people will say, like, oh, well, the Irish built America. They built these cities, especially like Boston and New York and other East Coast cities. And Yeah, I don't know. That just raises even more questions to it as well.
Well, yeah, and I think that's definitely an area that needs to be explored. I've spoken with someone named Michael Hoffman, who he's written a book of like about when the Irish were slaves. And, you know, there's a huge history of taking people as slaves, but they weren't necessarily called slaves because they would be like, you know, basically contracted or conscripted to a boat. You know, so you would essentially be like the lowest rung of the deck crew, and then maybe if you were lucky, there was a shot of moving up the ranks, right? But it's my understanding that a lot of the people that, you know, have kind of populated the world and contributed to this melting pot effect, where there's, you know, people all over the place, it's got to do with trading, you know, and that's not a new thing, you know. So what if it's like, even so, that it's not that the Irish were all like left, you know, they all left during the potato famine. Maybe that's just like a way of remembering some event that has a different truth to it. I don't know, that feels vaguer than what I was aiming for, but I guess my point is like the history of like the countries interacting with each other. Like, we have this idea that before the age of exploration, everybody was just in their own country and like just they would just go and fight the people next to them. But they've had boats since before the flood, you know, they've had boats before, like, you know, long, long time, right? That's the whole Ark story, right? Like, we've had boats. That's not a new technology. So I just feel like this idea that, oh, Irish people come from Ireland is even like, it's even kind of like, how do we even know that? Like, I would say Irish people are in Ireland. Yeah, we know that. But are they from there? I mean, what does that even mean to be from somewhere? Because there are people that at a certain point in history moved into the jungle. And because the jungle is such a radically different environment, they become pygmies. And it's not just in Africa. There's pygmies in Indonesia, there's pygmies in South America. So like, humans in a rainforest become pygmies, right? So like, you know, to me, I think like that says that the environment has a lot more to do with the vibe, like the person, than the person, you know, maybe has agency to control. So like, what if being in Ireland makes you a little Irish and you start to, your hair starts to sprout red, you know? I don't know. I'm sure that maybe a geneticist might laugh at that and be like, that's crazy. But who knows? Maybe there's something to that. I have a little bit of red in my hair, and it's not like, it's obviously not like a common thing in my family line, because I'm the only person in my family with any red tinge at all. But apparently my grandfather had a bunch of brothers, and a few of them had like straight red hair, so that could be where it's from. But I just think like to myself, like, maybe there's a time when all these people were told like, oh yeah, no, you're Irish. It was this other culture, right, that, yeah, those people ended up in Ireland, but they also, as you kind of alluded to, there's hundreds of millions of them around the world. So what if they weren't actually like Irish? What if they were like these seafaring Phoenician people that just lived in ports all over the world, because that's how they got on, you know? They would go boat to boat, place to place, and that's the type of lives they lived. And yeah, they were in Ireland, but they didn't identify with that land. Am I making sense? Like, and then at a certain point in time, like, they were like, oh no, you guys have to identify with this piece of land, because the days of you, you know, sailing wherever you want, however you want, are over, right? Is that kind of making sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. It's like, I just think it's so silly that people want to, you know, classify themselves and be so tribal over imaginary boundaries. You know, that to me, it always blew my mind. And what you guys were talking about, we're kind of seeing that play out in real time with America, with all these immigrants coming in here, because their kids will be American, but Are they? So we're kind of seeing it play out now. I just think it's crazy. History repeats itself.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm sure the Native Americans, you know, when they saw pilgrims and settlers coming and building little wooden boxes on the shores, it wasn't the first time that they had encountered that. I'm sure of it. Because they didn't, like, if you really look at a lot of those stories, like, they, maybe some in South America, you have a different, maybe a different conversation, because some of those stories depart from what I'm about to say. But if you look at like what happened in New England, the settlers, the pilgrims, they wouldn't have been able to survive without the Native Americans intervening and teaching them certain things. That's what Thanksgiving's all about. And, you know, you can't just teach somebody something if you've never spoken their language. I mean, yeah, you can communicate a great deal with sign language, and you could probably work out like a pidgin language that would eventually kind of bring you to the common understanding. But it feels to me like, and this is kind of, I don't know, maybe a new theory, maybe it's an old theory, maybe other people used to think this way, but I tend to think that it's more of like a psychic thing. Okay. And it's like, it's not even that the Native Americans necessarily needed to understand English. It's more like they have the same psychic root language, and like the words, their meanings were conveyed in a way that I guess we wouldn't really understand today, now that we've turned our language into a technology, right? And I'm not trying to say like, oh, all Native Americans were super mystical and the Europeans weren't, because the Europeans were mystical too. Like they had witches and stuff. That's how the witch hangings happen, right? So there was tons of that stuff going on. But I wonder if it was more of like a, I don't know, like an ancestral or instinctive type of thing, where wasn't necessarily that they understood the exact words that were being said, but they understood like the kind of psychic technology of the language, because it hadn't been so densified back then. Like things were more fluid as far as language were back then. Now we live in a world where there's a book that will tell you all the words in this language and all the words in this language and all the words in this language. But there are, I mean, probably, I want to say thousands, but that could be an underestimate of the amount of languages that have existed. There's probably millions of languages that have existed. I mean, currently there are probably more than just thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, but throughout all of human history, there's been millions of languages. And I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I look around at history in the world and it seems like people have got along pretty well. Like we've been able to get ourselves to a certain point. So yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'm not making as much sense as I was hoping to, but I feel like we have these barriers of understanding that come from our modern way of being in the world, and we need to kind of lift those modern biases a bit to see into the past and maybe draw a deeper understanding from the past. But then again, you know, hey, maybe what I'm saying is just so abstract that, you know, as these things are kind of abstract, like the past and history, like, you know, maybe if you're coming at this looking for like a concrete evidence answer, you're not going to get it. So you need to kind of navigate in the abstract. So yeah, for people who maybe aren't used to that, this subject might not be the most satisfying, but you know, something that isn't abstract is the stones. And that's what I always come back to, is because like the stones, they're not lying. Like the stones, they don't lie. They're not telling fibs. They are what they are. They are where they are. And there's a story to be told. And yeah, we're just not getting that story in full from our mainstream authoritative sources. I don't necessarily agree with all the Tartaria stuff that I see online, because I think some of that can get to a foolish level. It's on the same infrastructure of energy of curiosity, it's on that same scaffolding of questioning. So I appreciate it in that sense. But I also, when people try to tell me like, oh, well, there are all these star forts that were here before the Europeans got here, I don't buy that. I think the star forts were built when they say they were built. And as a matter of fact, like, there are tons of stories that the Native Americans could build stuff like that too. So it's like, you know, yeah, maybe the star forts were here before this Europeans got there, but how do we know that the Native Americans didn't learn that building technique from a earlier group of Europeans that came here and built a star fort? Because it seems like that's like what you do when you establish a port, you build a fort, you know, like it's just what you do. So yeah, I mean maybe that's why we have these star forts all over the place that are seemingly older than they're telling us, because they were totally fine with taking the Native Americans' land from them. So why wouldn't they take their forts and stuff, right? I don't necessarily think that we need to dismiss the Native Americans from the conversation. I think they're definitely a part of the old world conversation, and they need to be reconciled. And when you tell me that all these cities were here beforehand, it's like, okay, well then why don't the Native Americans have stories of living in cities? And there are a few cases where people have said like, oh, the Cherokee had bricks and they would build things out of bricks. As far as that goes, I still have to look a little deeper into that story on the bricks and the Cherokee and paved roads and whatnot, but that's the only story I've heard that's even remotely close to what I've seen purported on social media. And I think it kind of does the Native Americans a disservice, because they have tons of very, very fascinating aspects to their history that are still waiting to be explored. And, you know, maybe that's for them to decide even what they want to keep to themselves and share with the rest of the world. But I know, as someone who was born in America, I feel perfectly comfortable and that it's my right to know the history of the land that I was born on. And that's what I'm going to investigate, you know? So that's kind of where I'm at. And the Tartaria thing, it really did also inspire this as well, because when I started seeing a lot of these memes really get like super popular, I would look at them, but then I'd be like, well, what evidence do these people have other than the photographs they're showing me? And at that, like, the conspiracy community never trusts any photographs that NASA gives us. So why would we trust any photographs that the people from the 1900s are giving us? Like, they were all Freemasons, you know, a lot of them were Freemasons. A lot of them were robber baron, oil tycoon types. Like, not everybody had a camera back then. It wasn't cheap to have a camera. So I have a lot of skepticism with the photographs of Tartaria buildings and saying, oh, look how the building's been buried. And I'm like, well, have you never heard of a basement floor window? Like, that's a thing, you know, people don't always want to have a dark basement. So yeah, I don't know. I have a hard time buying a lot of the Tartaria stuff, and I'm glad that it exists, because it's pushed me to look into what I think actually happened. And again, hey, I could be wrong too, but hey, look at what I'm finding and tell me where I'm wrong, and I'll be open-minded to it. I've yet to see someone in the Tartaria camp take criticism well. They usually respond the same way the flat earthers do, and argue and debate, and that there's a place for that, but not when you're on the proving end of the debate, you know. So rhetoric only gets you so far in those areas.
True. And I agree with what both of you said, that the imaginary borders, or even the maybe potential telepathic communication, and it's obvious that at a time we were much more connected than they would like us to be or believe. And it serves them well to, well, when I say them, I mean the powers that be, you will, or in this specific case, the secret societies that kind of formed America. And kind of their whole deal going all the way back is, you know, to divide us, to hide, you know, universal truths for us to just keep it for themselves, whether it was telepathy, magic or maybe the origins of different peoples or places. And that seems like a good way to segue into this Skull and Bones. So like, what do you think that their main doctrines or objectives are, really? Because I don't know a whole lot about Skull and Bones, to be honest. I've deep dived on the Masons and there seems to be some crossovers. I've listened to some of your shows about them, and obviously the Bush family is well known for being part of Skull and Bones, but where do you think they and other secret societies kind of fit into the narratives that we've been told?
Well, when it comes to Skull and Bones, there's, you know, a couple authors who have done the majority of the research as far as, you know, what I kind of base my understanding off of. That would be Anthony Sutton's America's Secret Establishment. And then there's another book called Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, and that's more like a compilation of different authors put together by Chris Milligan, who I've interviewed on my show. And yeah, I took that source material and I've kind of used it to try to understand maybe where the secret societies fit into the other parts of the equation. Some of the things that we've already talked about just here in this conversation, like, you know, history and what secrets they have about history that they're keeping, because, you know, that's what secret societies do. They keep secrets, but they also funnel power. And that's really what the bulk of what you'll learn about secret society is, you know, like any secret societies, they find themselves behind different events in history because they're trying to manipulate it, usually to gain more power or express their power or what have you. So with Skull and Bones, it's pretty accurately, you could see it as like a recruiting segment of this larger secret society, right? Because it's not Skull and Bones operating on its own, like, you know, some comic book-esque Legion of Doom kind of thing, you know. It's more like Skull and Bones is like one of the villains in the Legion of Doom, right? So that's kind of the major understanding, is like Skull and Bones is kind of like it's one tentacle on this octopus, right, as some authors have put it. So yeah, as far as Skull and Bones goes, it's kind of funneled the Ivy League system, you know, the elite of this specific area, whether it's, you know, you go to Yale, you join Skull and Bones, you go to Harvard, you join the Porcelain Club, you go to Columbia, you join, you know, whatever they have, whatever their version of Skull and Bones is. So this is a thing that exists in all colleges, but with Skull and Bones, it was kind of the preeminent one, and definitely one of the more notable, considering the number of people who have gone in and out of Skull and Bones to become, you know, notable and impactful on history, namely the Bush family, right? Two individual presidents, father and son, both members of Skull and Bones, two political candidates going against each other for president, John Kerry and George Bush Jr., both members of Skull and Bones, right? So it's just when those sorts of things happen, it's like, oh, hey, what's going on in the world? And, you know, I was alive during the Kerry-Bush presidential election. I was a little too young to fully understand the whole Skull and Bones thing, but I remember that coming up on the news. And, you know, there was even a local reporter who went and climbed on top of one of the buildings and tried to film what goes on behind Skull and Bones in their little private garden area behind their headquarters, their meeting building. So yeah, it's something that I think on one note is pretty easy to understand, right? Like these powerful people rely on exclusion to keep the reins of power under control, and also to make sure that they have the right people that are going to do the job they're looking for, and also maybe the right people who are not going to spill the beans and maybe get people in trouble, because there's a great deal of drug trafficking that's historically been related to this whole, not just Skull and Bones, but the group, the college, Yale, and the families behind it, right? Making their money in certain things like the slave trade and drug trade and things that are illegal and require the right types of people to, you know, not only be in the behind the reins of doing the illegal things, but also behind the reins doing the legal things to help cover up the illegal things, right? So you don't just need pirates to go out and get the drugs and smuggle them, but you also need judges to make sure that when the cops catch your smugglers, you know, they go to that judge's courtroom and that judge makes sure that those smugglers get out and don't have a hefty punishment or a fine or whatever, right? So, I mean, this is just how corruption works, and secret societies have always kind of been convenient tools for people who want to be corrupt. And in America, you had a time when this radical group of Freemasons said, hey, we're going to kick out the monarchy and we're going to make it a free republic, like we've been reading about in the classics. This republic based around a constitution. It's what the Romans and the Greeks, these great men of the classical world that we've read so much about, you know, they've given us these ideals, and we're going to take those and we're going to combine them with some of the really good ideas we've stolen from these nifty noble savages that we just met here as we were conquering this land, as the Romans did. You know, we're going to take some of their ideas about, you know, the council and getting together, and yeah, we're going to call it a democracy. And so, you know, in that atmosphere of like, oh yeah, we're going to change the world, there were people who came to America who, you know, they were rich, and they were rich in a way that, you know, makes their great, 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 great grandchildren also pretty much guaranteed rich, right? So that's like, these are the types of family, wealth, power we're talking about. And they, you know, they weren't happy that, okay, now this country is, you know, free and everyone's equal. Like, no. Back in Europe, I had all these great agreements with the king and they were going to give me land. And I thought I was coming to this country to rule and be like a duke, like my cousin is back in who knows where, you know, Warwick, whatever, England or whatever, right? Like, this was the idea that a lot of people had for the New World. And you can see it in the colonies and some of the treaties and the ideas that they had in the colonies. You know, here in Connecticut, where I live, a lot of the ideas that they came up with in their articles I forget what the exact word is, but essentially like a constitution or a bill of rights is what they created for themselves as a colony, so that they wouldn't be, you know, under the thumb of the monarchy. You know, those ideas, a lot of them inspired what became the Constitution as well. But, you know, in some ways, they were also kind of like still very much attached to the old ways of doing things. And, you know, any conspiracy theorist will tell you, like, hey, America, even though we have the Constitution, the federal government pretty much negates all of our constitutional rights. So, and the federal government's been around for, I mean, what, only 30 years less than the country has, right? Like, they pretty much put the federal government together a couple decades after they put the real, you know, the other government, the first government together, right? So, yeah, it definitely feels like the powers that wanted this place to be free eventually lost out to the old powers from the old world, who created, you know, the universities and such, so that their children could go on and become kings and queens too. You know, it's kind of like that model applied to a virtually free world that still conforms to a class system that comes from the old world, the classical world, the monarchy run society, where church and state are one. You know, we have this illusion here in America that church and state are separate, and that's what makes our country great. But, you know, they don't talk much about the black church, you know, and I'm not talking about African American or black people. I'm talking about like this magic, this occult stuff that historically also has been going on here in America. You know, people left Europe for religious freedom. That was a big part of the American story. Well, they weren't just, you know, seeking religious freedom because they had taken umbrage with interpretations of St. Paul's verse. It wasn't just that. It was like the rules that the Bible was enforcing, or at least the rules that people were enforcing based on the Bible, right? And then other people were like, no, my Bible says that I'm going to live my life like this, you know, like you can interpret your Bible that way, but that's not how I interpret my Bible. It wasn't just that, you know, that was a big part of it, but there was also people who were, you know, practicing pagan magic and, you know, things that had kind of lived through the Inquisition and the Roman conquests. And, you know, even though lots of pagans were burned or converted, there were still people who kept up those old traditions. Yeah, I think that's kind of a big factor here in America. And again, something that the secret societies would have been a conduit for. People who want to participate in things that are illegal, they go and do their acts in secret. And there was a certain time in history where magic and all that kind of stuff, the occult, was illegal. So it was right there with drug trafficking and prostitution and all the other unsavory things that are still illegal, right? And I'm not saying all things that the law says are right. I don't think the law is rooted in universal truth. But when it comes to this country, you know, and the secret societies getting behind the reins of power, those are the influences that you have to consider. The occult, what's illegal, what criminals do. You know, these are the factors that have been very much a part of the incubation of America. So, you know, to think that, oh, history's a lie, yeah, no shit, because that's how they cover up their illegal deeds, you know?
You pretty much covered right what I was going to ask you on the next one, because I think when we're trying to maybe explain this to, or this type of info, exposing corruption or whatever to maybe less than informed or maybe more naive friends, it's not really a stretch to imagine like powerful people want to keep power in their family and that they, you know, will do what they can to stay in power. But the occult and dark magic type of stuff that you see in either Bohemian Grove or the Masons or Skull and Bones, and like that's where some people kind of fall off, or they don't want to go down that route because it's a little bit dark or it seems a little unbelievable to them. But it's very clearly part of you know, like you said, the history of this country, the history of secret societies as a whole, like just some weird magical practices. And you can almost speculate that it works because they have such power and they've propped themselves up into such places of influence that these rituals and magic and stuff that they're doing has a very real effect on our reality. Yeah, I love all that. And anything else you would like to close on, Mark? This has been an epic conversation. We'd love to have you back on again.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. And I guess I'll just finish kind of my point and say, like, to reflect on what you just added to the discussion. And it's like, yeah, people have a hard time accepting that secret societies could wield so much power because they've been given a false version of history by secret societies. I mean, one of the things I was hoping to mention, and I will, is that Skull and Bones, and the members of Skull and Bones specifically, have gone on to play instrumental roles in creating the education system of the United States. So you could look up John Klyzek's School World Order to learn more about how they've dumbed down the average student in an American classroom over the past 150 years. You know, this process started around the before the Civil War and has only increased, you know, after the Civil War, right? We're talking 1832 is when Skull and Bones was founded, and it was founded with this kind of German Illuminati sort of Hegelian philosophy that was injected into this very elitist and supremacist type of group that thought, yeah, well, we're better than everybody, You know, we're God's chosen people. We're amazing. Nothing can stop us. So, you know, this is the psychology of where evil kind of begins in some ways. You know, great people of history have thought this way, you know, and they haven't all been all good, right? I mean, even people who have changed the world in tremendous ways, you know, they tend to be some of the worst people from history in tremendous ways as well. So yeah, I think when it comes to like secret societies and people having trouble accepting it, you know, it's just a fact. It's something that you can take my word on, but I wouldn't advise that, because if you're going to take my word, you'll take anyone's word. And I'm not trying to sit here and be humble or anything. I think I'd make a good point, and I think I say it well. But you have to be discerning, and you have to understand that everyone has an agenda, and not everyone's agenda is going to be as benign as mine. You know, I just want you to listen to my podcast if you think what I said is interesting, and maybe support my Patreon so I can do this instead of going back to working a normal job. So yeah, that's kind of my whole, you know, two cents on it. And I felt really grateful that this has worked out the way it has, because it's given me the opportunity to step outside of the normal society to some extent and kind of sit back and have an outside perspective on it. In one sense, because hey, I still got to go to the grocery store and the gas station and the auto shop and all that stuff, right? So yeah, I definitely am grateful to be able to talk about all this stuff. But I do advise people to, like, yeah, always, not just with my work, but always go and follow up on what people are telling you and see if you can back it up and prove it. And if you can't, well, maybe that tells you what you're looking at isn't worthwhile, or maybe it's worth looking into even deeper, right? Like with me, I'm like, oh, well, they're not giving me a good explanation for why these stone structures are all over the woods around Connecticut and New England, New York, Pennsylvania. So what am I just going to say? Oh, well, I don't know. No, I'm going to keep looking. And I've found dozens of books now that weren't immediately available that now I've, you know, found here and there. And yeah, I think this kind of thing can happen for any one person, for any one subject. It's not just the old world stuff or even conspiracies. You know, I think we live in this kind of self-organizing world that allows for our consciousness to kind of probe forward ahead of our own awareness and like bring us to cool situations based on how optimistic we are and also how curious we are in many ways. So if you're listening out there, be optimistic and be curious, because those are two tools that you're going to need in 2024 and definitely onward.
Definitely. And you are very well spoken. You got a lot of knowledge to talk about that this short conversation can only scratch the surface of. So any of the listeners, definitely be sure to check out Mark's podcast, the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast, where there's tons of more good information for you to take in. And we'll definitely look forward to talking with Mark in the future.
Yeah, thank you so much, dude. I appreciate this. I learned a ton. I'm an avid listener to your podcast. It helps, like you said, it helps me get through my workday. I always have my headphones on, and a lot of the time I'm hearing your voice. So keep it up, man. I appreciate the good work. Motherfucking Mark. Mystic Mark Stevens.
Steves.
Mystic Mark Steves. Yeah, he's seems like a really good dude. He really is well spoken. You know, there's certain people that have a vocabulary, and I, you know, I have a decent vocabulary, but there's certain people that have the ability to pluck the right words out of the air at all times. And I don't have that all the time, per se. I do have a decent vocabulary, but sometimes I struggle looking for the right word. But he always seems to pull exactly the word he's looking for, you know?
He would make a great author if he ever does decide to write a book. And what I like about him, too, and his show, and I think that's why I listen to it so much, is I mean, I do my best to not get frantic and just start ranting like I do in real life sometimes, which leads to my family thinking I'm crazy. But he's very calm and precise and, you know, just information based, and that will always help in this realm of not making what you're talking about look completely batshit insane.
He covered so much, you know, like I can't even put like a stamp on it. He covered so much.
Right. And just one short episode is hardly enough. So we'll definitely have to get with him again.
Yeah. I mean, his knowledge is impressive. It really is. I mean, it almost seems like you could just throw like a random topic out there and it feels like he could just go for like 20 minutes on it, you know?
He's literally interviewed so many people, and like he said, he spent a lot of time listening to things. And
No doubt. Don't get me wrong, there's certain areas that, you know, I could say Druid and you could, you know, boom, you'd go off for 45 minutes. And, you know, there's certain things you could say to me. You could say, you know, ghosts, or really my jam is UFOs. You could say anything about a UFO case. I could just go on about that. So his knowledge is really impressive because it doesn't seem like he's limited to one area. You know, it seems like whatever, he can just go. But yeah, like you said, he's been doing it for a long time. We will be there one day.
I think we're on the right trajectory, and we have now got Mystic Mark's blessing.
Yeah, no doubt, as well as everybody else that's already on board. We got listeners from pretty much all of the continents that count. We don't have any South American listeners yet, but soon.
Maybe those governments are trying to keep us down.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe we're shadow banned in South America already. Oh, fuck.
Well, I know. We appreciate all our listeners.
Yes, every last one.
Appreciate us. Give us that 5-star review.
Mm-hmm.
Like, share, follow us, message us, hit up all of our social medias, get on that Patreon, become one of the first members
of the syndicate.
We are starting to compile some content over there for you.
Yes, we are. We definitely are. And once we get some more of you guys on board, we'll go ahead and unleash the beast. Shoot us an email if you have any suggestions, conspiracyandchill@yahoo.com. And I think that's about all I got. Stay away from child molesters.